Welcome everyone to today's programming languages. Last time we've seen how dispatching of functions works in the direct manner, the static dispatching and the dynamics dispatching. And today we're going to have a look at the support data structure structures that are created in memory at runtime of an object-oriented program, and have a look at how particular features of object-oriented programming languages have an impact on these support data structures. And for that, we're going to have a look at how the inheritance principles in the language change the underlying infrastructure. So let's dive right in. So what we're going to see today is first of all a little bit of an introduction into the principles of inheritance and what different inheritance concepts are out there, like the difference between interface inheritance and implementation inheritance. And we'll have it how the infrastructure needs to be in order to be able to dispatch in presence of these principles. We'll have a look at how C++, as an example language for this chapter, lays out the heap structure for managing objects. We'll start with a few basics of we're going to look, and for that we will have a short introduction into the way that the LLVM compiler suite internally deals with its code representation. So that's what we're going to start with in this one, and then we're going to start introducing features, like first of all ordinary single inheritance, and then we're going to have a look at how dynamic dispatching changes this view by introducing virtual methods, and later on we're going to extend that step by step with things like multiple inheritance over here, virtual methods once again, this time with multiple inheritance in mind, and then the matter of dealing with common ancestors inherited through different parent lineages. So this is going to be the ultimate in the C++ multiple inheritance for us here. In between, we'll have a short excursion in to concepts from other languages that also offer multiple inheritance through a different route, particularly the route where we pre-decide certain conflicting choices by offering linearization from automatically decided in that sense. So there is the problem of if you take or if you inherit from several parents, you might wonder if you have the same offerings from both parents, which of the parents will come first in serving certain dispatching problems. So there's a kind of ambiguity in there, and this is solved in an automatic way with linearization. So we're going to have a look at different approaches to perform linearization and nail them down in a few algorithms and exercise them on selected examples. So that's what we're going to do in this lecture. So let's dive right in. Last time we have focused a lot on Java and its view on inheritance, and there's especially from beginners, there's often the question, why do I have to limit myself with just one parent. Wouldn't it be nice to have several parents on there? And I see already people shaking their heads. And it's not so much about if you really want to do that. It's a matter of what you have to do in order to provide that for me here. So it's not to judge, but to kind of show you the effects that these kind of things have on implementation of programming languages. So I'm more or less indifferent to the whether I like that or not. So first of all, when we talk about inheritance, what do we mean? So there are several notions of inheritance that are used in the wild, and they have somewhat different implications. So the kind of classical motivation that you have maybe already had contact to in the beginner's lectures is the argument of code reusage, or at least probably you will have had something like that as the motivation for inheritance. And what you usually hear in these lectures is that what you can do with inheritance is that you can write your piece of code that is able to reuse methods that have been implemented beforehand for a similar object that was more general than the one that you do. So what you usually do in this this setting is that you specialize software by just providing the increment that is actually of interest for your current problem. And you can access parents' implementations of methods in a kind of a library fashion for all the issues that you are not particularly interested in specializing, but just are satisfied with the generic implementation. So, after a few years, I'm not so sure whether these language examples are still applying that much, because languages are changing a lot, and I'm not so sure whether it's more a matter of libraries than languages. So maybe ignore this implemented languages like part in there. So it's a matter of library concepts, whether authors of libraries follow the route of code reusage via inheritance or via other means. So, that is one of the approaches to inheritance. The other one is establishing behavioral contracts. So, the idea there is that you provide an object with methods whose signatures have been predetermined by some kind of other library code. And what you do is you keep to those predetermined signatures in your object in order to be able to hand that over to the library method to do its job on the object. This usually also comes with a kind of a protocol that tells you what the methods whose signatures you're providing are supposed to do and in which kind of connection they are with each other. So this is more like the approach of library functions acting as frames of code that implement, for example, a particular algorithm, and leave open space for your own items to plug into this algorithm, so to say. And Thus, you can customize algorithms that are, well, out there in a generic fashion. And, this concept of inheritance goes very closely with this concept of an interface. And you have languages that have made this kind of interface concept explicit. And these are usually these languages like Java or C#, where we have an actual first-class language member that's really called interface in that sense. So, with those means, you can make this behavioral contract-style programming as a main concept in your language. So, these are the two ways of perceiving inheritance as a means of programming. There's examples for those things. So, for example, there's this idea of interface inheritance, where, for example, you might have a library of interfaces like the ones over here that determine the interface that a particular data structure should have, like a stack or a queue, for example. There might be a lot of algorithms out there that make use of stack without really saying what particular implementation of a stack should be there, or same goes for a queue, for example. And, well, if you want to feed this algorithm with a particular concrete instance of yours, you are supposed to implement these interfaces by providing concrete methods for those interfaces or interface methods. The other notion is the one of the implementation inheritance, where you go a route of things like lack of other simple examples. Here there's the idea of modeling items of the real world in that sense, and there's the concept of a ship around and the concept of an airport, and they are pretty reduced to their basic facilities, like the ship has a horn that can be tooted, or the ship can be moved from one coordinate to the other. And the other concept is that there's airports around, and the main purpose of an airport is to give shelter to a plane. And if you model something like an aircraft carrier, you obviously have the same abstract features as the ship as well as the airport. You can give shelter to planes, and you have a horn, and you can move around. But you might also be specialized a little bit more in the fashion of moving to foreign countries and create havoc there. So that is the kind of increment that is provided with that thing. So that is the idea of implementation inheritance. So the aircraft carrier can make use of the implementations of things that have been implemented for parent objects. So, apart from just these theoretic aspects, what are the implications on the organization of my runtime environment, particularly the object layout that I encounter when I use particular features? In order to talk about that, we need some kind of way of talking about the memory implications, and for that I want to introduce you to the internals of one exemplary compiler, which is this LVM framework. So this is not just one compiler, but it's a kind of a compiler suite that can be fed from several front ends and has some kind of common middle part, where the particularities of certain front ends are abstracted away and are reduced into a common intermediate representation, thus the name IR. And the idea is then to that these front ends only invest as much intelligence as necessary to produce this intermediate representation and not much more in order to concentrate the attention on optimizing the intermediate code with joint forces, so to say, so to get a quite optimal code out of that with as little resources as possible, and then write out target specific code in the next phase. So this is the phase where the target independent optimizations of the program are performed on. This intermediate representation is done in assembly-like form, so you get a very reduced instruction set of, well, depending on what your interests are in looking at these programs, but in principle you don't have too many different instructions that you can find, and they have a very basic format, never using more than two parameters in that sense, apart from the function calls, of course. And yeah, the other thing is that, well, there's interesting properties like you have single static assignment form, which means that each variable is written only in one line of code and never changed again throughout the rest of the program. So you always know where to look at the source for a particular value, for example. So apart from that, everything is organized in well, in a model where you can create arbitrarily many temporary variables that you can fill with the results of the computations that you need in order to evaluate expressions or feed function calls or receive the result of the function call and all that. And they are usually prefixed with this percent sign for our purposes. The anonymous temporaries we just enumerate with one to whatever we need. There's also named ones that have some particular connection to the high-level elements, like variable names or things like that. But yeah, they won't necessarily be carried over in each step where you reevaluate or where you compute a new value for a variable, for example. And there might be a new identifier introduced for that. Apart from the instructions that deal with the execution of the program, there's also another part that serves for modeling types. So that is something that you usually don't find in assembly languages. These are well, that's kind of a sub part of the language that that lets you specify how data structures look like. So let's maybe first of all look at how that works. So there's a concept of primitive data types for our purposes. The ones that are of interest for us are the integers, and types for those are usually prefixed with an I and then followed by the bit width of the integer type, so 32 for 4 bytes, 64 for 8 bytes, and with 8 for just 1 byte of integer. Then you can create arrays of basic types. For example, in this thing over here, this is an array of 20 times integers of 30 bit width. You can even nest them in each other. So this is an array of 10 times, 20 times 32-bit integers. And you can use them to be nested inside of struct definitions, for example. Struct definition is a thing that you see right here, where the keyword type starts the definition of a new struct, and then there's brackets, and in this bracketed structure you can have a comma-separated list of all the plots that are inside of one of these structs. So the struct for B, for example, carries at first an integer of 64 bits, then an array of the form that we have talked about earlier, and then the third component is just of type integer of 1 byte. You can even nest them in order to create recursive data definitions. So there's this type over here with the that has i32 as its first element, then it has structure of type B following, and then this bugger over here, which is what is that? That is a a data type for a function pointer that has a parameter of type integer of 32 bits and returns also an integer of 32 bits. So that's basically what you can expect to find in the following slides. There's maybe also more to that, but it's not so interesting for the purpose of the following slides. I think with that you should understand what is mentioned later on. Then, of course, there's also a lot more instructions than just the ones that I have put on that slide, but with the ones from here and a little bit of explanation from my side, I think you should have enough material to understand what I want to talk about in the next slides. So what is there as facilities? You can create space for objects with an alloc A and a type name, for example, which gives you a new pointer to that data structure. Then you can access the member of the so created object with, not plain arithmetic, but with a special purpose instruction, that is this get element pointer thing. So this is a pretty complex construct that is there to represent kind of the usual pointer arithmetic that you need in order to access components of deeply nested data structures like the ones that we have seen in struct A and struct B. So in our case here, there we want to access something. Thus, there's this get element pointer instruction over there. And this works on the data structure given as the first parameter, thus this percent %A. And in order to help the get element pointer to know how to interpret the navigational expression afterwards, what we are also given is the type of the data structure that we need to interpret the navigational expression on. So this tells us that the pointer in percent %A is to be interpreted as a pointer to data structure A. So this is kind of a helper annotation for this get element pointer thing. So what is supposed to be interpreted is given as comma-separated list after the first argument. So this might be an arbitrarily continued list of integer values that tells us where to access the the structure. So in our case, what is done is we find that that we need to navigate somewhere within this data structure of A. But first of all, this thing is a pointer given by this little star thing. So this means that the first parameter that we are given over here is interpreted as, well, as pointer things can be also seen as kind of an array. You might want to navigate in this array to a particular index. And in order to just do a simple dereferentiation of a pointer, what you do is you access this potential array at position 0. So this is how this first parameter is interpreted. 0 is there for dereferencing the pointer to the data structure. So we are conceptually entering the data structure with that thing. So now the next parameter is interpreted in the context of just the struct A thing. The struct A thing has three slots, 0, 1, and 2. And with the expression being 2, what we are accessing is the 0, 1, well, 0, first, second, the second component of this thing. So with that, we are accessing this component of struct A and obtain a pointer on this element of the structure. This can be now used as, well, maybe let's keep the color, can be used as this percent 1. And we now still load from that, since that is still a pointer. So that's where this load comes into play. Load from that in order to actually receive this value and be able to work with that. So that's what we are doing over here. And with this percent 2 now, we have the function pointer that was stored in the structure. And this we now can use in order to perform a method call, which is issued over here by the instruction call, and it's called once again with helper annotation being the type of the function pointer, in this case returning i32, having a parameter of i32, then the actual calling target, which is in our case an indirect call. It is a dynamic value that we have read from memory somewhere, thus this variable name. And then there is a parameter, which is in our case a constant, but could be some other variable. So this is this 42 thing over here. So, then there's a return value of this call that is then put into this RED12 variable. Is there a question on this part? Yes, please.
What was the purpose of so that the get pointer was the purpose of i640 and it's quite attached?
Is the index part in the array or say
this one here. So the first part was a pointer too, and well, there's this duality between pointers and arrays in this C world, and you could also, if you had something different from zero, then you would, as an effect on the target machine, add the size of the data structure, like this pointer to struct, to the base address, and if you have it, you add it the many times that you put your value in there. So that's that. Yes. I'm I'm not sure whether I got that right. You want to know a way in C++ to represent the length of an array? Is that just this size thing? Ah, well, in that case, you would just have this pointer symbol in there. So, good. So, even if you're not so sure how particular high-level features correspond to low-level code, you can easily try out yourself how this works out by just using the LVM intermediate representation, or well, not using it, but generating it. You can just feed it with your user-provided source code and put that through this command line over here in order to create some LVM code to check for yourself. So with that, you can create your own intermediate representation file. And particularly if you are interested in the memory layout of certain structures, like the ones specified over here, you even get some kind of pseudo graphical representation in ASCII art out of the compiler by using the command line over here, which is quite handy if you are interested in how these object structures really look like. So since we are focusing on particularly that in the following slides, I just wanted to highlight these things to you. It's no magic what I've painted over there. It's just things that you can create yourself also by using these two compiler lines. So to start you right off, let's begin with a very basic example of a class hierarchy, which you find in the following slides, always on the left over here. So this is your source code part. Then there's the part with the kind of specification in language form over here. And you always get some visualized form of that painted with my amazing MS Paint skills in the top over here. And usually I also want to focus on some kind of coding problem, which usually found over here, and the corresponding low-level code you find over here. So that's kind of the idea of the layout of these slides. The diagram over here has or will have several components. In the first few slides, we will usually only find the left part of this graphical thing, which is meant to be the representation of an object as it is created by the constructor of a class. So this is a thing that is there several times in memory, depending on how many calls to the constructor of a particular class you will find, and each of them creates such a thing. What we usually get out of the call of a constructor is for all purposes of the intermediate code, we will get a pointer to the start address of a memory representation, with the memory addresses growing in this direction. So the memory addresses are larger the more you go to the bottom of the slide, so to say. So yeah, that's start. Usually a lot of these images that I present you are kind of incrementally read. So is the case also for here. If we have a base class A, which is kind of the beginning of everything, it just carries one method F and an attribute A, and the object representation of that thing would be this part of the diagram. All you need to store during runtime or during lifetime of your object is the actual value of the attribute carried with it. So what you usually do for that is you reserve space for the attribute A. Then in this manner of, well, object orientation by providing extensions to more general implementations, what you can do in these settings is incremental specifications of new classes, like you see over here. The class B extends class A by also managing an attribute B and also adding a new implementation like this G thing. And for this purpose, there's a representation for objects of type B, and this is that part of the diagram over here. And you see the layout that has been chosen for an object of type A is even in the object representation view extended by everything that is necessary for representing object B. So this is just appended to the end of the representation. And the same, of course, is also true for class C. So there's kind of a reusage on that thing. And this is particularly important, since there is the concept of casting classes, casting objects to base classes. And why is this so handy? Well, if you cast your object that is of type C to something, to some type of one of its parents, like A, for example, the layout that is expected when you look at the memory representation that your pointer to the beginning of the object points to, well, is already compatible to the layout that would have been there for, well, for the case where your object has been created by the constructor for class A, for example. So in that sense, even if you cast your object into parent type, you don't actually need to do any change to your object layout, since, well, it's just compatible to the one that you already have, and usually you don't have any purpose in overwriting anything that is supposed to be off limits from your current representation, meaning that this, even if you consider your object as being of type A, for example, you would never try to overwrite B and C, because, well, there could be anything over there, even something important. And that is exactly the case here. So, yeah, that is the kind of base concept. So, let's have a look at how method dispatching in that context works. So, I've put up a small example here where we create an object of class C and then call one of the methods that is provided by the C object. So this object is generated by just allocating enough space for class C. Then, well, in principle there would be some kind of constructor. In our case we don't have anything like that, so that's omitted. Then we reach an actual instruction that's supposed to do something, particularly calling G. And that's what we do over here. Please note, for the particularly for Java programmers over here, there's no mentioning of any virtual keyword or anything like that. So this is just static dispatching that's supposed to be done. And static dispatching means that you can directly write the target address as a constant into your call instruction, or in our case, well, this is just the label of, because I don't expect you to know what a numeric constant will be there. So this is this is meant to be a label of an address in your code segment. So, yeah, but it's a direct address that is over here, not a variable, thus this head symbol. And in order to translate that call, you now also see that the thing that I've promised you, particularly that this special treatment of the receiver, which was this part over here at the left-hand side of the dot, is now on the assembly side interpreted as the first parameter of method call. So there goes this special treatment of the receiver. And what you should also note is that the parameter over here is, well, there's this helper annotation of the actual type that is expected to be here, and this is expected to be a pointer to B. Why is that? Well, G, which was the method which we wanted to call, was declared as a member method of type B or class B. This is provided by the code generation part at some point with a particular signature, and the signature that is necessary in order to for this to work in all possible situations would be, well, of course you would want to have this method working also for objects of class B, because, well, that is the class in which this was specified. Is there a question? Yes? I would say that there should be no difference then. Not perceivable in that sense. Yeah, we will see that there will be other things as soon as you start with virtual mesh, because you need to have this virtual method pointer. And but for this simple layout, I would say that this would directly translate into space reserved in your data representation for that type, and thus. Thing. But you can try that out with the instructions from above. But anyway, back to the matters at hand. So what you need here is to provide a pointer to B, which is, well, in LVM, there is facilities to convert types from one into the other. There's an actual bit cast instruction, and this casts from a particular type into a particular type. In our case, from pointer to C into pointer to B. However, in our case, this is the pointer to the representation of C points here, the pointer to representation of B also points here. So this is essentially not doing anything apart from satisfying the type system, but in principle that this is what is automatically generated, because here in that spot we need a pointer to B, and we will see that there will be situations where there is an actual change in the address, but for our purposes that's not the case. So why is all this talk about this B so interesting? Well, this is to do with the way that the implementations of methods internally are wired. So I give you the code for method G in our case, which takes a parameter P, but also generates an access to the attribute that was mentioned in class B. So, function definition gets, of course, the receiver pointer this, and its seemingly first parameter p, and can work on these things by referring to those two names. And yeah, in order to do the actual addition of these two things, we need to access, for of course, p. Accessing p is simple, you can just use the name for that. However, accessing b is not so simple then, because, well, b is hidden somewhere in the memory, and particularly we will find it being there. So how can we actually access that? For that, we have learned we need to use the getElementPointer instruction to navigate the data structure. That is what we do here with the getElementPointer. And here we see that we navigate a class B pointer thing. And since it's a pointer, we dereference that pointer. And we will find that the attribute B is found in the not zero but first slot of the structure, thus here. So this generates us a handle to this element of the struct that we can then in the next place then load from. And with that we can do the addition. Why is that so important now? Well, this this tells you that the way that the function g is implemented, or generally functions are implemented, or well, member methods are implemented, accessing attributes by constant offsets to the beginning of the object representation. So this is the first slot in the structure for B. And since we don't want to generate too many functions for all the combinations of inheritance situations that we run into, we want to reuse this implementation. And if you want to reuse that for reuse that in the context of structure C, we first want to cast it to an according pointer. So far, that is not a big issue, because we haven't seen any layouts where the start pointer changes depending on the view of the object. But we will see situations of that place. And there, this is important to remember. The original implementations of methods are always assuming that they are addressing their attributes from the start address of the class that these functions have been defined in. So if the definition is done within class B, then the implementation of G assumes that accesses to B are relative to the start address of an object representation of type B. So that is kind of an invariant that is there for these types of method implementations. Okay, so with that in mind, we can now move over to the case of polymorphic calls, or dynamic dispatching, as we have called it last time. So, what we have seen as a possible implementation of dynamic dispatching was this idea of at runtime, whenever we encounter a call to a dynamic function, to issue the actual runtime dispatching with a special means, like this invoke virtual on the Java virtual machine, or, well, since in LLVM this is not directly represented, I have kind of forged something over here, which I called dispatch function, that is meant to, in spirit, do the same thing as this Java virtual machine, and particularly run through the superchain starting at the dynamic type and look out for a particular signature of a method until it actually finds the appropriate method and then call that address. In our case, this is the case how dynamic dispatching has been done in the Java interpreter, and we have seen the way that this is done in the last talk. However, you should keep in mind that this is just the interpreter. What is usually done in virtual machines, also in the Java virtual machine, in its, well, not so new implementations by now. Hotspot is around since a decade, I would say, so it's at least, so this is not so very new. So the Hotspot virtual machine is not a pure interpreter anymore, but only on the first run it starts interpreting the code, and on subsequent runs, particularly at hotspots, so spots that are encountered times over times again, what is usually done is there is a protocol that notes what the dispatching function has found in the past, and at some point the code will be rewritten from a direct call to the dispatching function into a statement that asserts that the runtime type of the object found there is still the one that it has been for the last 100 runs, for example, and then we just take the address that has been found 100 times throughout our running history already and just put it there as a constant and call that after the assertion has passed. So in the future we will just cache the run through the superchain that we have done several times again, and just use it as a direct dispatch compared to what the static dispatching would have done at that place. So although this run through the superchain looked quite heavyweight, what is done in practice is actually the code will be, well, if it's executed only once, well, then who cares? We have fast CPUs, and if it's done over and over and over again, the hotspot will take over and rewrite this part of the code with just a constant over there, and will act like static dispatching has acted, and this is really, really fast. So the third possibility that is out there is, instead of doing this dynamic run through the superchain, what we can do instead is trying to pre-compute the dispatching result at compile time and offer a simplified lookup procedure at runtime in order to determine the actual dispatching target. And this is usually done in form of tables. Well, in the beginning of object-oriented programming, when we had things like Smalltalk around, the idea was to provide, well, a two-dimensional lookup structure, like a two-dimensional matrix, where you could look up for a particular class identity and a particular function signature, the actual, well, I used symbolic addresses like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but you would look up the concrete implementation address in these things. So, that did the job to a certain degree. However, you already see in the diagram over here that there's a lot of unused space over here, and if you happen to have really large programs with a lot of different classes and a lot of different signatures, you will get quadratic growth with depending on the number of signatures and the number of classes. And you might not want to have that, particularly since this is a very, very sparse matrix. So for that purpose, you might invest some time and come up with the next optimization, which was the idea of having row displacement dispatch tables. These made the two-dimensional matrices superfluous and, made use of the idea that there is potential for sharing space, particularly the white spaces in these two-dimensional matrices. So why is there potential for saving space? Well, for example, if you look at this and this over here, you see that everywhere where there is an actual entry, the entry is the same. So you can just collapse both of these lines into each other and have the type system keep the call to G on a C object away from the actual code in the end. And with when the type system guarantees you that, then you can safely just collapse those two into each other. Same goes, for example, for red was meant, this one and this one. The other thing that you can make profit of is the idea that even though lines might not have anything in common, what still could be in common or what could be complementary is the actual white space. So these, for example, and these only use a fraction of the actual table. Well, this is not so good of an example, but you could move this block over here and share the space with that. So with that, you get some kind of overlapping dispatching entries, but since the since there's a lot of white spaces, you can just keep on compressing them into each other until you hit actually used slots in these dispatching tables. All in all, what you are aiming for with that is in the end having a linear dispatching table and as many white spaces reused as possible. Even more, you can invest a lot of more things and just try to create as much space as needed for each combination of inheritance relations that you find in your program, and that is what the virtual tables and particularly this talk is about. So that is something that is used in C++, in the LLVM and GNU C++ compiler, and in a similar but not literally equal way also in the Microsoft C++ compiler. So there's subtle differences, but conceptually this is still the same idea than the one that this LLVM and GNU C++ does. So, what changes? We now see that in the high-level part, we still have A, B, and C, but we obtain a new keyword called virtual, and all the methods F, G, and H are now virtual, thus dynamically dispatched. The execution of the code down here is still the same, at least on a high-level code. And yeah, then there's this this object representation diagram over here, and now we see that there's also another box appeared. And this is the representation of this so-called virtual table, and that is the one where the information about the about the dispatching targets for the dynamic dynamically dispatched methods comes from. So now, in terms of object layout, what changes in detail is you see that the representation for class A, although A only has one attribute, which is this one over here, now also has a new member. This one over here that doesn't have a direct correspondence to a high-level feature. This is a technical addition to the object representation that comes through the use of the virtual keyword for any of the functions in there. So as soon as you start labeling any function in your class as virtual, what you get is that the very first slot in your object representation is now reserved for carrying the virtual table pointer. So this is what this slot is all about. It's the virtual table pointer, V pointer, over here. And its purpose is to point to a one-dimensional array that keeps the addresses of the dispatching targets for all the virtual methods, and it is depending on the nature of the class from which it is pointed to. So a different class will point to a different data structure, thus having this disambiguation between virtual method called targets in context of class XYZ in comparison to class C. So what this also means is that as soon as you start using virtual methods, what you implicitly do is you will create a numbering of all the virtual methods. So implicitly all of them will get a number which corresponds to an entry in the virtual table. So these are the entries 0, 1, and 2, and will be used whenever we want to actually find out what or we want to call a method of a particular class. And if we want to do so, the purpose is to look up in if you want to call, for example, an age, we will always have to look at the second slot of the virtual table. If you want to call an F, we will look at the zeroth slot of the virtual table. So this is a unique numbering, which is the numbering will be consistent throughout the children of this of this class. So, so much about that. Let's have a look at what we actually find in there. So, when we look at the object representation for a C object, as it is produced by the C constructor, what we will see is that we will find the of course all the attributes declared within A, B, and C. In the usual manner, A's attributes come first, then they are extended by B's attributes, and then they are extended by C's attributes. So the usual composition by extension is still in play, but the virtual pointer is not replicated for each of the extensions. The virtual pointer is shared throughout all these extensions and is always statically the first slot in the object representation, thus accessible as zeroth index within the representation of C. This points to a data structure which is filled with the implementation of F from A, since there is no overridden version of F, then the implementation of G from B, since G overrides this thing. So, yeah, for the Java people, as soon as I mark a particular method signature as being virtual, it counts as being virtual throughout the children. So I don't need to repeat that thing. But implicitly, the methods still remain dynamically dispatched, of course. You can do so, but this won't affect any former things. I don't know whether you can actually really redefine something as being virtual from now on. I'm actually not so sure about that. You would have to check whether you can do so. But what will not be allowed is that you retrospectively make something virtual. So maybe the C++ guys here, whoever has his laptop with a C compiler on, can check that. But I'm not so sure whether you actually can reuse a known signature as being virtual deeper in the hierarchy. But what will not be allowed for sure is that you retrospectively make something virtual, because you can't use this construction for that. Okay, so anyway, there's then the entry of H coming from C, which means that this H over here is overriding the implementation from the base thing. So this is what I try to tell you when I use these names over here. So this is the implementation from B and the implementation from C. So what happens then when I execute such a dynamically dispatched method is, well, you now can't directly mention constant address anymore in terms of a label. What you now need to do is you need to compute the actual dispatching target. And you do so in the virtual table world by, well, what you get is your entry pointer to this object. So what you do is you check for the virtual table pointer, dereference that over here, and then go through the list with the index that corresponds to the method that you actually want to call. So that is what is done in the code. So first of all, you obtain a handle to the virtual table pointer by, well, in our case, we can just be lazy and cast the data type for C to being just a table pointer. So this just works underneath because this just pointers in each of these cases. Then we can do the actual load in order to reach. Oh, flip. Okay. So to reach the beginning of the virtual table. So this is now stored in variable 1. There we need to navigate to the slot determined by this G. G, we said, was in our numbering the first slot. So that is what we navigate to in this get element pointer. Then we need to load in order to obtain the address of the method to call, which goes into this $3, which is then used as the address of the method that is called in the end, with the parameter being pointer to B, and the constant that was the parameter. So now there's computation involved in this thing. Okay, so far so good. Yes? Ah, this one. This is variation in compiler versions and heuristics on optimizing accesses to these things depending on the actual instructions that are found in the code. If you count, then you will see that this is a pointer to memory, usually of 64 bits on current architectures, being how many bytes? 8? Followed by I32, like 4 bytes, resulting in 12 bytes. So in terms of size, it's still the same, but the compiler, for some reason, don't ask me why, there's internal heuristics involved for that, or whatever comes to mind for the code generation, decides that it has to cast anyway for that part, so it uses some kind of unstructured type, like pointer to bytes in that case, so I8, and chooses to just reserve 12 bytes in there. So, as long as you use the correct get element pointer navigations with the correct indices in there, it's still fine. But yeah, there will be casts anyway later on. And I didn't want to lie to you by putting the original by modifying that to point to class A. But you're right. Of course, in principle, you would want to have this class A in there. And if you fiddle around a little bit with your access. Accesses to members, you might also revert that to actually point to class A, but yeah, that's practical systems for you. They don't always behave that nicely, but you have to be flexible for those. Yeah. So, what changes when we go over to have several parent objects? For example, we might want to look at code that has objects that are supposed to have several parents. What changes in our code now is, well, I've reverted the changes to the dispatching. It's now static again, F, G, and H without virtual. But now, instead of B inheriting from A and C inheriting from B, we have A and B being endpoints in inheritance, and instead the A and B are now parents for C, as well, on the same level, so to say. So later on we want to create an object of type C, so we have to at some point decide how to lay out that thing, and since memory is linear, we will have to we won't have the option, as we have here, to have A and B in parallel. So we somehow need to decide how to lay them out. And we have to put them in some sequence. So what we usually do is to take the order in which the parents are mentioned over here as the order in which the parent representations precede the child representation, or the extension that is the child representation. So what the constructor new C will produce is still a pointer to this thing over here, and code that is specified in C knows that C has two parents, so it is aware that there is offsets to go in order to reach this A and B. Apart from that, what is there is that this B is now arranged with an offset to the original start of the object. So this now screws around with the invariants that we have talked about, particularly the ones where we were talking about how things... things like this implementation of the G method. Remember, we said that accessing methods from B was supposed to be with an offset to the beginning of the representation of B. But you see, for B, in this setting here, it doesn't know that it is preceded by an A. And in the setting where we call G potentially from a C thing, well, this might now be a little bit ugly because, well, we now need to actually do something in order to call a function on G. So is that... Oh no, it's not directly over here, but what was actually happening now is that we will, in order to call a G then later on, we will have to cast the C to a B before. Because that is what is expected for a method that is declared in B. And thus, there will be a cast from C to B for in order to do that call. However, this is not no-op anymore, as it has been before. But now, we need to actually modify the pointer, because the pointer to C was actually pointing here, but what we would have needed is to point to here. So what actually will happen is we will have to modify the pointer by the offset that B has within the representation of C. So this is what's happening over here. We will have to add 4 times the size of a byte, so 4 bytes, which is actually the size of A. 4 bytes is what the I32 is all about. And with that, we can modify the pointer to the beginning of the object to point into the middle of the thing, and thus receive a pointer to class B. So, as soon as you start using multiple inheritance, you start the fun with casts actually really changing method pointers to objects. Beforehand, you didn't have anything like that. You should also keep in mind that for languages that don't have multiple inheritance, like Java or, I don't know, C#, I have lost the overview a little bit through the last iterations. Is there multiple inheritance in this one? I think not. Probably not. So let's just say for our purposes here that this is quite similar to Java and it has only single inheritance. So in those languages, there is no need for ever adjusting the pointer to an object. No matter how you actually cast, we will always be able to work with the same pointer to the beginning of the object. For multiple inheritance languages, like the way that C++ is implemented, you may encounter changing pointers as soon as you start casting on these things. So, yeah. Turns out that I have also the code for the method call in that setting. So, yeah. Here, even if we stay on the with the variable C, the static type C, we still have the cast involved over here in order to create the appropriate type for our receiver parameter, and we still have the modification of the pointer by the size of the presentation part A, which is this delta B. Okay, but at least what in our setting we still have is that the address that is called is still statically known, since we don't have any virtual method calls in this setting. Okay, so as soon as we start with this multiple inheritance topic, we should also be aware of the danger of having ambiguous code now. So if you have several parents, of course, what might happen doesn't necessarily need to happen, and it happens probably not as frequent as this slide might make it seem, but there is situations where this happens, where you have several parents that offer function or methods of the same signature. So whenever you issue a call to these things, you might wonder now what this method now dispatches to. This is something new that we haven't seen in the last lecture, since we didn't have multiple inheritance. So, what should we do there? The way that C++ handles this is let the user bother with those problems. The compiler will just bail out with an error message, and what you need to do is you need to explicitly qualify what you have meant when you wrote the call expression. There's other systems around that say, well, there's also an automatic way to deal with that. No need to actually bother the user with error messages. So, magic. We will do... And what is behind that is that the compiler will implicitly generate a linearization of all your parents in a way that it is possible to say which parent will be preferred in order to take the specified method from. And, well, in order to do so, you can have several different algorithms for that. The sources for information for these algorithms are usually two. There is of course, the inheritance relation. So if we have classes that declare to be extending some other classes, that's a source for information for the linearization algorithm. In our abbreviated kind of language-independent way of writing that is the way that I mentioned it over here. So class C inherits from classes A and B, for example. This is how I write that. So in that sense, this is the same as C extends A and B. And in terms of inheritance relation, this leads to C inheriting from A as well as C inheriting from B. Of course, there's also other sources of information. For example, you might also take into account the so-called multiplicity of parents. Don't ask me why it's multiplicity. That's just from the literature. I've never doubted that name. However, what this means is that the order in which the parents are mentioned in the extension clause is taken as a source of information for deriving linearization information. And if I inherit from A and B in the sequence, first A and then B, then this is also taken into account as ordering information and leads to this multiplicity source. So, with those two types of information, the job of a linearization is to provide a total order on the classes, and this total order is the base on which the search for dispatching target for object fields or methods is on which this is carried out, and the idea is that this is a uniform mechanism for all methods that are supposed to be dynamically dispatched, or fields that might be dynamically dispatched, and there's no difference in which you take. So it's just depending on the class and not on the actual identity of the method. In literature, you might also find the linearization being called the method resolution order, or MRO. That depends on which literature you're actually looking at. Just wanted to mention that in case you check the background literature and are somehow confused then. The other thing that you need to mention is that linearization is something that won't always succeed for every example out there, and can be considered to be a best effort approach at best. So there's different notions of how to perform linearization, and not all of them are pleasant for certain examples, and pleasant is something subjective, and well, depends on the actual variant that is chosen for linearization. So what's out there as concepts for method resolution? Well, the first approach is the historically spoken, the most simple one was to just perform their first search on the inheritance tree. So I've drawn a few examples for you on that side, where you see these are these generalized inheritance clauses. A inherits from B and C, B inherits from W, C inherits from W. I've drawn you the inheritance graph. The black ones are the ones that that stem from inheritance. The orange ones stem from multiplicity, and I've put that little corner in there to indicate which inheritance clause was the one that was responsible for creating this edge. So, yeah, that's the way of making that graphical in that sense. So, what happens if we do that first search on this thing with, well, starting from the left? Well, what we will get is, well, that first search starting from the root will go to B first, then to W, then backtrack and go to C and be finished. So we will, what we will get is A, B, W, C. Right? Is that convenient? Shaking heads? Yeah, so, well, if we use that as our linearization of parents, we will get that W is considered to for a source for resolving your dispatching target before C is even touched. Well, that is probably not particularly desirable, so this is violated. You might be astonished to hear that this has been in use for actual linearization in my programming language of choice, Python, in versions prior to 2.1, so very nice, nicely done. Then, what can be done better? Well, there's the idea of performing duplicate cancellation. What is duplicate cancellation? I do my depth first search, like this A, first B, then W, then I go back, reach C, and then with C I still reach this W. W has been there before already, so I had this A, B, W, reaching C, then I again reached my W. So what I will do is I will cancel the duplicate and add it to the end of the list. So I get that. So first principle is fixed. That was the way to do linearization in 2.2. This looks quite fine. However, if you do things like the ones over here, where you have a slightly more complicated object structure, well, turns out this is a quite complicated example in the sense that you can't really find a linearization which will fulfill, for example, principle 2. So there's no linearization that will do that, because this contradicts the way that C and B classes inherit from their parents. However, what is really strange is that in the linearization we find that B is considered before C. However, B's way of specifying the preferences of parents, like V before W, is not reflected in the way that the linearization is set up, because that is actually the other way around. So, yeah, well, that was something that was not so pleasant. So people have moved on and tried out other examples, like the post order rightmost depth first order in reverse notation. So, yeah, facepalm. we could try to apply that now to that example here, but it's rather lengthy, so I will spare you that and just do it over here. So this will act as kind of, well, quite a nice idea. However, we'll not be able to solve all possible situations. So there's also other ones that you can construct, like the one over here, where you will find that still you'll be able to violate this darn multiplicity. So what can you do in that sense? And then this is kind of a interesting approach, is that you can modify this reverse post or the rightmost depth first search in a kind of a refinement way by paying attention to the violation that that you're not content with. For example, in our case, which was the violation, I think it was this G and F being in that sequence. However, the multiplicity says that G needs to be after F. The refinement way of this particular linearization is to, well, as soon as you realize that that is something that you find non-desirable, just change it. Change this edge into an actual inheritance edge and rerun the algorithm. And that is what the refined reverse post-order rightmost depth-first search actually is. So this just changes the edge into an actual inheritance edge. And with that, now you can rerun the whole thing on this refined graph and then get a satisfying example, or in the end fail to produce anything due to conflicts in inheritance, like having edges in both directions. So you either fail or you produce something that you find pleasant. Well, there's also actually practical systems where this is implemented, for example, in the CLOS object orientation system for Lisp. However, this has been the early years, and please don't be mad at me for kind of making fun of Python, because this was actually one of the languages where the author really made an effort of making it transparent how linearization has evolved over time in its language, and there's not so many language authors who really do that. So kudos to this guy. Please don't laugh at him. He really made an effort for getting it right. And in the end, he switched over to some other system, which is kind of the standard right now, and attacks, serves a new principle that hasn't been mentioned to the two sources before, like inheritance and multiplicity, particularly the monotonicity, which means that the actual property that you're interested in these systems is that whenever you create a linearization, for example, for just this for this class C, which sees only that part of the class hierarchy, the linearization of B, which only sees that part, and then in the end a linearization of A, which sees the whole part, that the ordering that you have assumed that classes are in child linearizations are the same in in parents linearizations are the same linearizations in child's linearizations. So in that sense, the whole system is kind of modular, and you can have consistent dispatching experience also in child classes, and this is what this monotonicity is actually about. And turns out this refined mumbling of a strategy is one that doesn't guarantee monotonicity. So what is the actual so for example in this case, yeah, you can have varying relations between F and G depending on which part of the graph you're actually looking at. So, what can you do? And the quasi-standard of linearization nowadays is the so-called C3 algorithm, or C3 linearization, And this works in a compositional way. So you construct linearizations of the parents first, and then out of that, recombine that in order to create linearizations of parents. I might remind you that our lecture is in principle reserved until 4 o'clock, so I would beg you to please... So, C3 linearization is this compositional thing. So what you emanate from is that you are able to access linearizations of base classes. Like this L thing is our handle to linearizations of things that we have created beforehand. And what you set up with these things is that, for example, for a class C, you know that there's base classes B1 to Bn. So there is linearizations for B1 to Bn already present. And you can use them in order to compute a linearization of your composed class then. And the way that you do that is the one that you see over here. You take all of these linearizations from the sequence and also the list of classes that you take from the multiplicity of this class specification, put them in this list, and then try operate this crazy operator over here on that, which is defined over there. And what that thing does is it runs through all the lists that are given as its parameter, takes the head element of each of these lists and checks whether this head element is part of any of the tails of all the other things in this sequence. If it finds that this head element is not present in any of the other tails, then this is this head element is suitable to be pulled out of each of these lists and is a suitable next candidate to continue the linearization and restart the algorithm with one of the lists now being one element shorter than before. So this is an iterative process, pulls out heads of lists one by one and restarts the iteration with shorter lists and runs until all of the lists are empty. And produces then a linearization of class names. That's just one list instead of a tuple of lists anymore. Example. Linearization of G and F is easy. G and F are just pure classes without anything else. So it's just G and F. E is inheriting from F. So there's not so much to do because the linearization of F is just F itself. So no algorithm to run. Same thing goes for D. It's just D composed with G. Now it begins to be interesting when I look at B, because B is now inheriting from F and G. Thus, it refers to the linearizations of F and G and the multiplicity, meaning the list FG. This is now inlined with whatever F and G is linearized to. So this is just those two letters. So we take this thing and we run through the list, check whether this is in the tail of any of the other things. No. So this is a suitable, thing to pull out. So this is pulled out of everything. This disappears. Also this disappears because, well, definition of this weird operator. And then everything collapses into just one G anymore, and yeah, that is the linearization. It is probably a little bit more clear if I continue with that in the next thing. So we set up this weird operator thing with the multiplicity and the two linearizations to which this definition refers to. So the first linearization looked like D and G, the next one E and F, the next one D and E. Well, this was not the linearization, but that was the multiplicity. So the algorithm now runs, looks at heads of lists, and checks whether they occur in the tails of other lists. D is in no tail of any other list, in a head, but doesn't matter. So that is pulled out as the first symbol and removed from that thing. I've done that like this. Next, I check for G. G is also not in any of the other lists, so I can pull it out, and then only E.F remains, and for that, it's just the same thing. So no complications in that one, just works the same way as before. So now the complicated one. There we have the first linearization looking like that, the second linearization like that, and this is the multiplicity. So step by step, we can execute everything until we reach that point, where we have to look out for the head of here, whether that is part of a tail, and turns out, yes, it is. So we can't choose this one as the next thing in our linearization to continue with. So this one we don't take. Is that a possible continuation? Turns out, no. This is also part of a tail of another list. So that one neither. So this one is an actual fail of a linearization. So for LA, we can't find a suitable linearization in that context. Turns out that is the quasi-standard for modern languages to perform a linearization. Python 3 does that, Perl 3 does that, and even Ethereum's Solidity uses that as a source for linearization. And yeah, with that, I want to stop because people are eager to conquer the room. Also, there's a lot of slides still missing, and I think we can continue next time with adding dynamic dispatching to multiple inheritance and concentrate on that. So thank you for your attention, and have a nice week.